Okay, we were kind of drilling down. We were looking at the appearance reality distinction, how we have a partly innate and partly conditioned, heavily conditioned habitual tendency to assume that things exist in the way they appear, when of course they don't. They do not appear in the way they exist, and that avidya that goes right back to the beginning, the origin of suffering, is actively assenting to things existing in the way they appear when they don't. And attachments and aversions are built up on that basis. And then, rather than that just being an intellectual idea, we were kind of drilling down into what's actually going on with perception. What's actually happening when we see things? And then looking at that and seeing that, for very good reasons, environmental and otherwise, sort of continuities are built up that aren't really continuities, they're discontinuities. Consciousness does the same, sort of plays a trick on us in that way. And so we see things or assent to things existing as they appear, when in fact they don't exist that way. And when we realize that that's going on, it doesn't change the appearances, like the Mulla Lyre illusion. It's just, you know, it's an illusion. It's not that it changes. The top one still looks longer than the bottom one, or the other way around, depending on which way it's done. But once you know it's an illusion, it doesn't mislead you in the same way. You can appreciate it for what it is, although the appearance itself doesn't actually change. And then we looked, if you remember, the couple of pieces I read from Rob Babbaya's book, that was also more about not things to do with perception, but the way we also things appear to us conditioned by or dependent on our own subjectivities. So it may appear that way to us. He examined the kind of retreat example, which I thought was quite good, and his role example, himself in different roles. You know, he was resident teacher at Gaya House, do you remember? So saying, well, am I always the resident teacher? No. He walks down corridors, he sits on the toilet. The resident teacher at Gaya House is a conventional role agreed, which he performs and does certain things for, but that doesn't define him. So there's no inherently existing, permanent, not dependent aspect to that role. So these are the more kind of psychological dependencies, things that come and arise from our own side. And similarly, you know, on retreat, what's the difference between being on retreat and outside? What's the difference between meditating and not meditating? If we reify, see these things over concretely, then we can get quite hung up and quite stressed and suffer as a result, because we're exaggerating the status of things. We're according them a type of existence that they can't possibly have. It's a fantasized existence. And when that's challenged, it causes grief one way or another. So I was looking at another one of those, because we'd certainly been down in drilling down. We went, you know, right the way down through all the from the level of this stuff to the level of molecules to the level of atoms to subatomic particles to string theory and the kind of now obvious conclusion, if you like, that there isn't going to be any end to that. That no ultimate particle is ever going to be found. Vasubandhu, a Buddhist philosopher, actually saw that from a logical point of view, you know, because the oldest schools of philosophy in Buddhism, the Vaibhashikas, were logical atomists. So then that question pops up. So what's at the bottom of all of this? Partless particles do what? How can there be anything, however small it is, that doesn't have a back, a front, a side, a top, a bottom, a north, an east, and a south, and a west. As soon as you say there is some tiny thing there, it has parts. And even if there were partless particles, if you tried to put them together, they wouldn't make anything. And that sort of becomes apparent. Well, Vasubandhu was aware of that as a philosopher of logical atomism a long time ago in India, and anybody that works for CERN or understands the research that's come out of it and other things will say, yeah, it's like that. That's how it is. So it's looking down there. Well, there's another one, of course. We did speak a bit about the fact that, you know, we all kind of, most of us, even if we don't know directly or know deeply, we know about Galileo and Copernicus, and indeed, you know, thought that goes right back to Democritus, Hypatia, and people like that. They sort of said, well, actually, the Earth goes around the Sun. Well, that looks as if the Sun rotates around the Earth. The actual fact is, it's the other way around. It's a really good example because we know that and accept that, but it still looks, the appearance remains the same, but it don't exist in the way it appears, like that, yeah? So there was another one, which I thought was just good fun and can convey something else, which is another nuance on this, and then again, it's food for thought. You can continue to think about others. And, you know, in the spirit of Calvino's lightness and not trying to make it heavy, how many of us are familiar with Monty Python's Galaxy Song? How many people know it? Nobody. Wow. I've won, haven't I? I've won the jackpot. So we're gonna watch it now. Yeah. But rather than go out there for a and set screens up, we can just watch it in here. And I'm thinking, where can I put this where we can gather around, as it were? Can I borrow your table? And then we could gather around somewhere here, couldn't we? Get the people around here. So this one's quite good because it's about, or it relates to, or says something about our subjective kind of, it appears to us to be a particular way. When, and this is particularly maybe if we're really miserable, really unhappy, and really down, and we're in a really mundane place. You know, you can imagine what it might be like for me in Kennington sometimes. But people in big cities rarely tend to look up. Yeah, rarely tend to look up and think, actually, it all appears like this, but I'm alive in the universe. It's a very kind of different perspective that comes to it. And also sometimes I thought when I first started to look at or be taught tantric Buddhism, and there was a part in lots of sadhanas and meditations where they say, imagine yourself surrounded by all sentient beings. I don't have to imagine that, it's true. As far as the universe exists, you don't have to imagine it, it's laid on. But because we're so detached from all of that, we have to create a little visualization of everybody around us, you know. So, but they're there anyway. Ah, interesting. Anyway, so for me, this one just gets it across wonderfully and in an amusing way. So, here we go. Let's give it a go. And I'll get out of the way.
Side to side. It Oranges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. How amazingly unlikely is your plan? And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, cause there's bugger all down the
The galaxy song.
No, I think it makes the point a lot of words.
It doesn't appear like that, but that's actually what it's like all the time. That's the world we live in.
As a reminder, I'll put the link and the lyrics in the bibliography. In the bibliography I send at the end. So we took that kind of step out to sort of drill down and see a bit more what the reality of that was, what it kind of means to say things don't exist in the way they appear, and that we kind of, without any further ado, mostly just assent to things to existing in the way they appear, and then making a sort of fundamental mistakes about the nature of reality. So, and then that we were trying to do that so that we could go back to getting a better understanding and a better appreciation of dependent arising. And my contention was, not just my contention, Tsongkhapa was the same and many before him, back to the time of the Buddha, saying, well, in actual fact, dependent arising, the fact that because of this, that arises, and the fact that it is a universe which is dependently arisen, in which everything is dependent on everything else, and which comes about by sort of conditioned co-production, there's not the possibility of having any of the sorts of entities or things or ways of existing that would be completely independent. Nothing dependent, existing from its own side, singular, partless, as kind of fantasized way of existing. If there's nothing like that that could exist in a dependently arisen universe, so in a sense, dependent arising and emptiness are one and the same thing. Things are empty because they are dependently arisen, because there's no inherently existing, independent, existing from its own side sort of stuff, and things are dependently arisen because they're empty. So there's a kind of a synonymy there. And Nagarjuna, in the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, he put it, because there are no phenomena that are not dependent arisings, there are no phenomena that are not empty of inherent existence. Nothing in it sort of existing inherently. So one of the ways to kind of simplify that and think about it is, all phenomena, you know, phenomena is just, you know, it's a big word covering anything and everything. We're phenomena, our mental events are phenomena, the book's phenomena, this is a phenomena. What sort of phenomena is it? A mobile phone phenomena. You know, it's a phenomenon, really thing. So everything, there's nothing that doesn't have parts. Jarvis is talking about Vashabandhu, you know, in logical atomism. Is it going down to saying, well, where are these, if we keep breaking down from molecules to atoms to subatomic particles to whatever string theory is pointing at, be that some form of electromagnetic radiation or whatever it is, it will have parts. So how do you draw a line under that? People say, well, partless particles. Well, no such thing. You know, if it's a thing, it'll have parts. So we can with some confidence say there's nothing that's not partless. You know, all things have parts, and the parts and the wholes depend on one another. So there are no parts without wholes, and there are no wholes without parts. Wholes, wholes, you know, in that sense. Whatever it is, if we say it's a whole thing, if it's a book, does it have parts? Oh, yes, it does, in all sorts of ways. It has a cover, it has contents, it has an index, it has a certain number of pages, it has a binding, it's made of paper, it's printed on, people brought it together and so on. So it arises dependently. We call that, designate that a book on the basis of its parts, and the very designation of it as a book means it's dependent on thought. It's not a book to a bear. It's a chunk of paper, barely edible, maybe. Throw it away. So the fact that it's a book, it's not only dependent on all those physical things, but the designation of it as a book means it's dependent on thought. Not wholly dependent on thought. It's not a figment of imagination or created by thought, but there is a conceptual dependency. Yeah? Table's a table. Table to us, not a table to a dog. Not a table to a fly. Not a table to a bumblebee. So that's the conceptual dependency. But it's not saying that's the only one. There are all these causes and conditions coming together to make that possible and for us to call it a book. Use it and read it. It's not permanent. It didn't exist once upon a time. We all know all the things that, from the wonderful Thich Nhat Hanh one of the rain forming over the sea, that dropping on trees, trees growing, being hacked down, paper being made out of them, and so on. That whole story. And then, of course, it will either go back into the earth or back up into the sky, maybe make more trees and more paper. So it's only temporarily in that configuration. And there's also an interest one that I can't give you a reference for. I will look it up if I can before the end of the week. But basically, if you look at the universe from a physicist's point of view and a mathematical point of view, you can't add anything to it or take anything away. It doesn't go up, doesn't go down. So all that goes on with all this lot is endless transformation. Yeah? You can't put anything extra in it, and you can't take anything out of it. So that's how it kind of goes. So although things seem to have their own entities, if they existed in the way that they appeared, then we should be able to point out a whole that's separate from its parts, but we can't. Whatever it is, you know, whether it's the book, whether it's me, whether it's the clock, whether it's the table, can we say, where's the whole thing independent of its parts? It's kind of a nonsense question, really, isn't it? We're chafing at the limits of the language. But we have a tendency to, when we are assenting to things appearing, existing as they appear, to kind of have that thought. We conveniently forget the dependencies, that it actually, it is like that, because all these other things, and we've labelled it like that. And then somehow we over-reify it, over-concretize it, and we think that there's something here called a table that's more than what's actually straight before your eyes, and that somehow almost we could take it out and say, look, there's the table. But of course there's nothing there. That doesn't exist. But we kind of behave as if it does. So they appear to have their own entities, but if they existed in the way that they appeared, then we shouldn't be able to point out a whole that it's should be able to point out a whole, should be able to come up with something that's separate from the whole, but we can't. So there's a conflict between the way the whole and the parts appear and the way they actually exist. Yeah? But this doesn't mean that there are no wholes. There are. Because if wholes didn't exist, you couldn't speak of something as being a part of anything. It's kind of like that. So the conclusion must be that there are wholes, but their existence is set up in dependence on parts. They don't exist independently, and we can't really understand the concept of parts unless we understand wholes. Yeah, they're two for a piece, they're inseparable. Yeah? So in Nagarjuna's Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way again, he says, that which arises dependently is not one with that on which it depends, and is also not inherently other than it. Hence, it's not nothing and not inherently existent. Just do that one again, because it's a very good one from Nagarjuna. That which arises dependently is not one with that on which it depends. Yeah? So it's not this, the table's not the same as its parts. If we took any of those one parts away, with possibly the exception of the top, then we put it on the floor, it'd just be wood on the floor, it wouldn't function as a table. Yeah? And if I said, oh, the leg of the table is the table, you'd say, Roy, what are you saying? You know what I mean? It's kind of like that. So that which arises dependently is not one with that on which it depends. And also, it's not inherently other than it. It's not completely different from it. It's not something else altogether. They're in a relationship of dependence. They're interdependent. Hence, it's not nothing. Yeah? But it's not inherently existent. It's not something other than there. And this very closely, if you go back and reflect on, again, form and emptiness from the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form, form is not other than emptiness. Yeah? It's not that form is here and emptiness is some transcendental thing over there, somewhere else. It's actually right here. What's empty? All this is empty. Empty of what? Empty of inherent existence. What's that? The idea that we can take a table out of a table and it has some kind of independent existence. It's like that's kind of clear. So dependent or independent, what's interesting to watch here in the logic and the language, we talk about dependence and independence. And of course, the language is not unrelated to reality. It's not in a vacuum. We're making a distinction with a purpose that actually hooks into the world. Dependent and independent, there's no other choice. If something's one, it definitely can't be the other. Yeah, we can say, oh, this is relatively independent of that. Or, you know, I don't live with my parents anymore. I don't work for anybody else. I have a lot more choice than a lot of other people what I choose to do with my day. So I'm relatively independent. But am I independent? Boom. No. Nor was I, nor ever was I. It depended on my mother and father coming together, making love, me being born. And think of all the things that have gone into bringing me here to sit in front today and the same for all of you. And all the things that continue to go on, if they didn't go on, our lives would start to fall apart. And if we remove enough causes and conditions, we'd be dead. So we come into being that way, we exist in that way, and when they're gone, they're gone. And if some of them come off and we're not dead, then we change. We look different, we feel different. Other people see us differently. We wear different clothes, we find ourselves in different situations. We're in different moods or whatever. So that's how it kind of works. But dependent and independent are a dichotomy. If something can't be independent, functioning under its own power, then there's no option but to see that it's dependent. In some way, it's dependent. So if you look at the table, His Holiness gives a rather good example of a table. Papers always philosophers, good ones, but sometimes. He says, a table depends for its existence on its parts. So we call the collections of its parts the basis on which it's set up. It's kind of what makes us call that a table. All of its parts, you know, including the fact that we call it a table. It's a conceptual thing. It was actually made by one lot of human beings for another lot of beings, human beings, as a table. That's our conceptual idea. We want tables to put things on. They're useful. Yeah? So a table depends for its existence on its parts. So we call the collection of its parts the basis upon which it's set up. When we search analytically to try to find this table that appears to our minds as if it exists independently, we must look for it within the basis, the legs, the top, and so forth. But nothing from within the parts is such a table. Thus, these things that are not a table become a table in dependence upon thought. A table does not exist in its own right. So the table kind of arises or exists dependently in three ways, or in three modes, if you like. There are certain causes that brought it into being. Tree, people, making stuff, shaping, tools, all the rest of it. And then it depends upon its parts. It has parts, get put together, and then it's kind of a table. And also upon thought, because when it looks like that, you say to someone, what's that? And they say, oh, it's a table. But they've been taught to say it's a table. And it actually came into being as a table because it was an idea in someone's mind. Wouldn't that be useful to have a table? Cup, clock. You know, they didn't just pop out. So they're dependent on causes, parts, and thought. So in this case, one's kind of more important. One of these things that kind of is the thought that designates the object. Yeah, it's the thought that said, "Ah, let's make a table. That's a table. Define a table." That, so whether it's a table or not depends heavily on conceptual ongoings and thought. So existing independence on thought and conceptuality. I mean, going back to our wander through contemporary physics, the kind of message post-relativity and quantum is certainly that things don't exist in and of themselves. If we remember our colour and sound and other examples, but really only exist in the context of involvement with an observer. It's not the only dependence, but it's an important one. Yeah, it's an important one. Part of their existence is dependent on the context of the involvement with an observer to exist in the way that they do. So if we bring this to ourselves, which is where we want to come and try and go, when I say I, which after all is only a personal pronoun, I, it can only be referring to something here in this kind of collection of aggregates, the mind-body complex, whatever you're going to call it. It doesn't make any sense for me to say it's over there. When I say I, I'm calling attention to the fact that I'm here. I'm using a personal pronoun to say it's me, it's this one. Yeah. But nevertheless, if we kind of investigate further, that really is all it is, a personal pronoun. It kind of conceptually designates this. Neither you nor I could come up with something called an I that has its own substance, that exists independently from its own side, apart from this. But we kind of think, because we appear to ourselves a little differently, that there's something else. Because we think we exist in the way that we appear rather than the way we actually are. So nevertheless, here I am, you know, Roy, a man, alive, here on retreat, talking about dependent arising and emptiness, sitting, walking, eating, sleeping, going to the toilet, all of those things. And this is sufficient proof, certainly for me anyway, that I exist. There's no doubt about that. No doubt at all. Even if I can't be found separately, that's how it is. I can't be found separately from this. I exist, but the I arises dependent upon thought. We can't posit it any other way. Is that making sense? I'm trying to keep it simple. But I'm putting this out, saying the way we kind of act, both in respect of ourselves and other people, lots of the time, means that because we over-exaggerate that and think that it does have an existence that it doesn't really have, we do lots of harm to ourselves and others and wander around in delusion. Which, if we weren't beguiled by that appearance, we would means it means you're not the object of the cow's attention right now. But that doesn't mean you don't exist. It means that for now, there's nothing about you that worries the cow. The cow's not aware of you, but that doesn't mean you don't exist. Yeah, I suppose you could, in a really poetic sense, say, right now you don't exist with the cow because it doesn't know you're here. But it doesn't mean you don't exist. It just means you're not in the purview of the cow's awareness. If the cow had calves and you were walking towards it within about 10 foot, there'd be an issue. Yeah, so it's not, and it's really important, this one. There's not a suggestion here that we're figments of our or anybody else's imagination. It's not classic Berkeleyan idealism. No, no. It's quite an important one. So it's good. It's good question. It's saying things. If we go back, things appear to exist in a way that they don't. Yeah, they don't exist in the way they appear. We think they do. That the kind of existence that they appear to have, they don't have, but they do exist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no doubt about that. That's really important. And exactly what I'm saying here. You know, here I am sitting, talking, and all the rest of it, and saying I have no inherent existence, but here I am. Yeah, it's the other way around. The inherent existence is the figment of the imagination. It's a kind of like an extra bit we add on. We kind of exaggerate the status of things, make them more substantial, more solid, more concrete than they actually are. And it's a bit Lynn's children, you know. If it were that way, then nobody would be able to change. You know, if somebody really were, you're inherently delinquent, then we might as well give up. Well, slaughter them. There's no possibility for change. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
The fact that people can change or transform or whatever, and that we can all learn to do different things, be different things, have almost different lives within a life without even thinking about rebirth, is only possible because there's no inherently existing us. If there were that sort of one, that's one, permanent, partless, not dependent on anything, existing from its own side, completely unchangeable, then nothing can happen. That will be the same with anything. What makes change and transformation possible is the fact that there isn't anything that inherently exists. That's what it's empty of, you know? Sort of like that. So, yeah. I mean, We have some hope, don't we? I mean, try telling this to Donald Trump. you'd be naughty. There was another very good one that His Holiness had. I particularly like this one. It resonates with me. And another thing with this, what we're doing here, is I'm just sowing seeds. Do continue to read investigate for yourselves, because a lot of this, the reasoning to do with emptiness and dependence arising, A, needs to be done repeatedly to really sink in, and B, there's lots of different ways of coming at it, and some resonate with some of us and others not at all. So if there's some that resonate, follow them through. Or maybe if there's ones that don't resonate, think, why aren't they resonating? But first of all, try the ones that you think, oh yeah, I get that, I can see that, or I've got an example of that, or that kind of resonates and works with that. I particularly like this one, so I'm just trying it out. It's this from His Holiness. There is no question that persons and things exist. The question is how or in what manner they exist. And that's the really important one to come back to if we get confused about, are we talking about existence or non-existence? We're not. We're not talking about either. We're talking about how they exist. Yeah. When we consider a flower, for instance, have we got a real flower? Yeah.
Yes.
Lots of real flowers to look at. We consider a flower, for instance, and think, this flower has a nice shape, nice colour and nice texture. It seems as if there's something concrete that possesses these qualities of shape, colour and texture. When we look into these qualities, as well as the parts of the flower, they seem to be qualities or parts of the flower, such as the colour of the flower, the shape of the flower, the stem of the flower, and the petals of the flower, as if there is a flower that possesses these qualities or parts. However, if the flower really exists in the way it appears, we should be able to come up with something separate from all of those qualities and parts that is the flower. But we cannot. Such a flower is not found upon analysis, or through other scientific tools, or even though previously it seemed so substantial, so findable. Because a flower has effects, certainly it exists. But when we search to find a flower existing in accordance with our ideas about it, that is not at all findable. Something that truly exists from its own side should become more and more obvious when analysed. It should be clearly found. But the opposite is the case. Huh? The whole and the parts, these are conceptual designations. Yeah? And there is the flower, it exists. But apart from that, there's no other flower. The problem is we exaggerate the status of it, over-concretize it, reifies it. We're deceived by the language that starts talking about, oh, the flower has parts. So we immediately think, oh, there must be a flower that has parts. Well, no, it's just a way of talking about
this.
There's not some independent flower that we could take away and say, there's the whole, there's the parts, and there's the flower. But we carry on like that quite a lot of the time, especially in regard to ourselves. So the point here is, if anything were truly independently existing from its own side, not dependent on anything else, should become more and more obvious. But we should be able to clearly find it. But the opposite's the case. But as we've just said, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It functions, it creates effects, and all of that. And let's see where we're going with time. Yeah, close. So the fact that it's not found when we analyse it and look for it just indicates that it doesn't exist quite in the way we thought it did. Not in the way that it appears to our senses, as a thing concretely established within itself. And I think then we go back to the example of the colour on the Cadbury's chocolate tin. I think we pretty much proved to everybody's satisfaction that there is no inherently existing colour. It's a phenomenon that appears because of the electromagnetic waves in the form of light that hit the rods and cones. These rods and cones cannot distinguish colour, remember? There's a mechanism in the brain that sorts it out because there's evolutionary value in doing so, and consciousness interprets that as a colour. And so that's what we see. So dependent on all those things, things are coloured. But there's no, you can't rip any inherent colour out of anything. And then if you spoke to any scientist, cognition, perception, neuroscience or whatever, they say, no, of course, colours are not primary qualities of anything. They're a construction by consciousness dependent on interaction with electromagnetic waves. So, and we ourselves are like that. And we appear to ourselves like that. There's a sense in which our own image of ourselves, which is, the sense of self just keeps arising in dependence on different causes and conditions moment by moment. We, because of the way perception is, feel it appears like a continuity, but there isn't a continuity. And then we say it's something solid. And then we say, oh, it's in here. And then we start talking as if we could find it, protect it, nurture it, do things. It just doesn't exist in that way. So Nagarjuna kind of demonstrates that everything is empty of inherent existence of this sort by the very fact of dependence arising. This absence of inherent existence is just a consequence of a dependently arising universe. It's we that kind of aggregate. They're not empty of inherent existence because they're here functioning, having effects, all of us and everything, but arise because they depend on causes and conditions. Huh? Anyway, that's a good place to leave it for thought because it's 10:55. So,